And you know what's going to happen now, Carson? You should admit your situation. There will be more dignity in it.
You go to hell.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let me ask you something. If the rule you followed brought you to this, of what use was the rule?
Do you have any idea how crazy you are?
You mean the nature of this conversation?
I mean the nature of you and you.
Joined now by Matt Taibbi, and I just want to say it's great to have you back, Matt.
Great to be back.
It was our first conversation with you, which was all the way back in May of last year, where I think we all first really started to feel like Trump might actually win.
Yeah.
I know, I sort of started to feel like that. Virgil told me that after listening to the interview. But, of course, we all sort of swallowed that thought hard and rationalized it away.
Right.
But, shit, here we are in week zero of Trump's America, and we're going to be talking about your book about just how we got there, Insane Clown President, which collects all of your best reporting from the campaign trail this year. And, like I said, taken in aggregate, you sort of look back on it all. I want to go back through the book and sort of go back over the campaign a little bit and touch on some things you talk about in the book. But before that, I want to just go on some shit that had happened just this past week. Because, look, I said to you before we started, yesterday for me was when, the despair really started to sink in. And, Trump, now to accurately attribute a quote to football coach Dennis Green, Trump is who we thought he was.
Dennis Green.
And we've just seen, the Muslim ban, no refugees. They're going to build the wall. They're going to create a registry of illegal immigrant crime in sanctuary cities.
I didn't even hear about that one.
Yeah.
He threatened to send the feds to Chicago to restore law and order. They're going to bring torture back. They've issued a gag rule on all federal agencies, like EPA employees, or you can't publish, I believe, studies of racial disparity in federal housing. And then behind all of that are these reports coming out about Trump himself, now the president, now in charge of the most powerful country in the world. And this one came out on Sunday. One of the president's confidants told Politico that his staffers have to, quote, control information that may infuriate him. A task made difficult by the fact that the leader of the free world, quote, gets bored and likes to watch TV. And now these are people on inside the Trump administration are telling this. And one of the things that immediately infuriated him was the coverage of how many people turned out for the protest on Saturday versus his inauguration. And just the second quick kick I want to do is from the New York Times. This is worth reading just almost in brief, but I'll try to do it quickly. It says, on Monday, President Trump gathered House and Senate leaders in the state dining room for a get-to-know-you reception, served them tiny meatballs, pigs in a blanket, blah, 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 and quickly launched into a story meant to illustrate what he believes to be rampant, unchecked voter fraud. Mr. Trump kicked off the meeting, participants said, by retelling his debunked claim that he would have won the popular vote if not for 3 to 5 million ballots cast by, quote, illegals. He went on to illustrate this story by passing along a story from what he said was a supporter, the, quote, very famous golfer, Bernard Langer.
Bernard Langer.
Yeah, Bernard Langer, the very famous golfer. The witnesses described the story this way. Mr. Langer, a 59-year-old native of Bavaria, Germany, winner of the Masters twice,
from Bavaria,
was standing in line at a polling place near his home in Florida on Election Day. The president explained when an official informed Mr. Langer that he would not be able to vote. Ahead of and behind Mr. Langer were voters who did not look as if they should be allowed to vote, Mr. Trump said, according to the staff members, but they were nonetheless permitted to cast provisional ballots. The president threw out the names of Latin American countries that the voters might have come from. It goes on to say that Mr. Langer completely has denied this story, is not even an official resident of America. He's still a German citizen, so actually he couldn't vote.
So what is it, a Bernard Langer impersonator?
this is just, he's like, Trump is like, I talked to my friend the golfer. He's very good friends with me. He says that there was lots of illegals voting. And he, no, but he didn't say this to the media. This wasn't on the campaign trail. This was in front of Congress. The government. Yeah, Congress.
And they were in stunned silence, right? Yeah. The article stunned says they silence. Just didn't know what to
like
say.
Like I said, you have this parade of just like nightmare shit that they're all trying to do, like being presided over by basically an infant.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite thing, it wasn't even from, you know, that yesterday. It was from like earlier in the week when he went to the CIA and he first he said, like, they gave me standing ovations. Yeah, I love it when I go to make my speech at the CIA and they do the wave. I love that shit. And but he, like, according to people, he like used his speech at the CIA to talk about crowd size.
Yep.
He can't let fucking anything go. He's talking to like these deep state people that ostensibly want to kill him, but he wants to. He's playing this. They want to play this complex game where they give them free reign in exchange. They won't undermine him, but he just goes there to talk about fucking ratings and media bullshit.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah,
it's fucking amazing.
No, you can't help but laugh.
Yeah,
choke down the tears.
But they're gonna have to shoot him with the tranquilizer dart from old school. Remember when they, you know what I mean? Like that's going to be the only solution to keep them away from the television.
Yeah.
Like they're going to have, or a net. I mean, what are they going
to
do?
They have to give them one of those hotel TVs. Like they get at a resort and it just tells him everything he can do at the White House.
It tells you how to play blackjack.
Just get him addicted to gambling.
That's why the people at Saturday Night Live have an amazing opportunity, because we know for a fact that he compulsively watches Saturday Night Live and that it enrages him. So they're going to have Alec Baldwin host, and it's just going to be him as Trump all night probably. But they're going to do all those dumb jokes that they've been doing since he won, like, oh, Russia, and basically just recycled George Bush as a dummy jokes.
Yeah.
What they should honestly do is just have him come out in a diaper.
Yeah.
And look into the screen and say, I like to drink pee-pee and eat poo-poo over and over again for the whole night.
And I have a half-inch penis. Like, that should
yeah.
be...
Probably die. Like literally die. Like, dead. He wouldn't be alive anymore.
I love that the president cares deeply about his sketch comedy. That's fucking awesome. The Groundling, no one has ever improved on the design the Groundlings had, okay?
UCB! Folks, UCB! It's a cult! Folks! It's ridiculous!
But, like, okay, so seriously, though, like, it's now week zero. Like Matt, what have you made of, like, this first week? Well, first of all, I want to get your thoughts. What did you think of the march on Saturday?
So I didn't see a whole lot of it, to be perfectly honest, and I didn't go, so I feel bad commenting on it. I did.
Well,
see that
you
there
should
was...
feel bad, Matt. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. And I did see that there was a lot of controversy about it, which I thought was strange.
I mean, like, a lot of people turned out, in at least in New York and elsewhere, to protest the Iraq war. I mean, like, I just more got the feeling, like, okay, Matt and I were walking around it in D.C., and I was, you know, the numbers were very impressive. Like, there was...
Everywhere,
like,
yeah.
Like, everywhere was...
17% of LA or something like that.
Something like one out of every 100 Americans was there.
I think, like, all said and done, it was about 1.5% of the U.S. population came out to protest this government, which is...
It's amazing.
Sort of amazing and unprecedented. But, like, while we were there, everybody had a sign, or every second or third person. And we talked about this a little bit. I found half of the signs to be like mostly liberal bullshit, or like, you know, and then the other half I thought were either just outright insulting the president, or like, I think a solid political message of like Medicare for all, you know, pro-choice, Black Lives Matter. So that 50-50 I thought was like a pretty good split given how most of these things are. Mm. And I feel like for like the normal like Hillary Democrat people, I think it's encouraging that like on day one they're sort of at a place that it took them probably 6.5 years to get to with George W. Bush.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
But at the same time, then my pessimism kicked in, and it's sort of like, well, this is a really good symbolic victory that I think we kind of needed as a country. But at the end of the day, it's just that. Like, everyone's going to go home and all of these assholes are still going to be running the country.
Yeah, except the thing that you're talking about before, that this is a president who's incredibly sensitive and thin-skinned. I think, like Nixon, who was really bothered by the fact that there were people out on the mall and protesting all the time. Protests actually matter. Like in the Bush years, Dick Cheney, you know, he couldn't have cared less that there were protests out there. But I think Donald Trump will notice.
Oh, he's definitely in his head, and as we see in these news reports, it's like he's still bitching about it to like his staff and Congress, which is incredible. However, like at least in contrasted with Nixon, I think what really got my pessimism kicked in was like, if you thought that 1.5% of the country coming out to protest Trump might stiffen the spine of Democrats in Congress, well then, buddy, I got news for you. Well,
no, I know, yeah. No, that's...
Well, sustained pressure. Like, it can't just be one protest.
Yeah.
I think it won't just be one protest like this, but the political importance of protests is not just to sort of rebuke the guy that you're protesting. It is to sort of send a message to your elected representatives. And unfortunately, it's going to take more than one for that, for these Democrats, these people who are sort of entrenched in this social circle where it would be inconceivable for them to vote against their colleague Jeff Sessions, even if he showed up in fucking Imperial Wizard robe. And I think it is encouraging. Like, look, the signs, you know, there's a fair share of ones that are like, you know, dude, Trump is gay with Putin. But it's like, not everyone starts out in life as like an irony poisoned socialist or communist. And it's good. Look, Matt said it. You cannot have a successful political movement without normies. They're just most of the country. And it's good that these people who like, yeah, okay, so on this shit, they may believe is either stupid or lame, but their heart's in the right place and they're pressuring the right place. And they do, for now, want the same thing that we want, which is for the Democrats to stand up harder, for there to be more obstruction. But I think it's encouraging. I remember the Bush years when we were waiting for this chunk of the country that was disaffected to sort of turn on him. And it's immediately happening. And if it, you know, you make it clear that it's less advantageous for people to stand with Trump, then he's less likely to enact more horrifying things.
That, yeah, he has zero goodwill, but the problem is, like, most presidencies really get the most done in their, like, first 2 years, and all this nightmare shit is coming down the pipe, and there's basically no political way to stop it.
But still, I think if it's not one time, if they park themselves in Washington, if they live there, if by May there are skulls on every post of the White House gates, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if it's like that, then I think it'll produce political errors by the people in the White House. Right. They'll make mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
The people in Congress will feel emboldened to go after him. I mean, these things they do have an effect, especially if it's all on television and there's a narrative that he's unpopular. Like, all that stuff matters.
I mean, yeah, ultimately, narrative, as we said, it's the most important thing, and it's can often be error prone, but less error prone than data science.
Right. Yeah,
and
exactly.
That's, that's the narrative. Like, everyone fucking hates this guy.
Right. Right. And people are impressionable too. Like, you know, if you're sitting in a, you know, watching this in rural Utah or something like that, and you're seeing that Trump is just totally ineffective, doesn't know what he's doing. Like, you know, I think what happened during the campaign last year is that he made everybody else look like idiots during the campaign process, because the campaign is designed to highlight things like outrageousness and you know, boldness and all these things. But actual governing, he's not going to look so good, I don't think, you know.
I mean, at the same time, though, he has been incredibly effective at enacting his agenda, and it's sort of horrifying at the clip at which he's moving, just because of, you know, the enormous power that they've given to the executive branch through, you know, that was sort of expanded by Bush and then set into stone by Obama.
Right.
Like, it's horrifying what he can do. Just
actually
signing at his desk.
Yeah, Matt, I wanted to ask you about that. Like, in the book, like, there was sort of a little bit of tension, and I wonder how you feel, like, about Trump. Is he a figurehead for this sort of particularly ruthless part of the ruling class that's now in ascendancy, or does he have his own agenda in a way? Could he go rogue on them in some way? Like, how do you feel about that?
I mean, my personal take on him is that it's a real rebellion against the GOP that they're going along. I mean, he's the president right now, and there's nobody sitting there telling him not to tweet in the middle of the night. You know, there's and a lot of these executive orders do have the flavor of I'm fulfilling my campaign promises. I don't necessarily yet buy the idea that he's this puppet of Paul Ryan. Like that hasn't happened yet,
right? You know, like, so like on things like trade, for instance, like he has an agenda that could break with Republican orthodoxy.
Yeah. I think so. And I also think the Republicans don't necessarily, there's a lot of things they don't necessarily want to do that he's already done. I mean, I'm not so sure that they want to do the denying visas to everybody in the world. I mean, like, the GOP is basically a business party. You know what I mean? They don't want to do anything that's bad for business. And he's doing a lot of things that are popular with the base, but they've tended to resist going to extreme measures in the past, right?
I mean, one of the things you talk about in the book is that, you know, Trump was astonishingly successful at calling the establishment GOP's bluff on a lot of this sort of self-image that they project about themselves, specifically about race.
Right.
And, like, from the first moment when he came down that gold escalator and was like, Mexicans, they're rapists, folks. Like, he just set off that starting gun and, man, like, was just running from there.
Right. I mean, yeah. And the thing with the Muslim ban, like, logistically, that's going to be, like, a nightmare to pull off. That and the wall and all that.
Here's the other
thing.
I mean, does it apply to people from Saudi?
It doesn't. No, it doesn't. They're not on the list. And actually, the Saudi embassy in New York, they moved about 6 blocks closer to Trump Tower.
Oh, my God.
Not just that. Trump founded established multiple shell companies in Saudi Arabia during the campaign. So, I mean, you know, you can talk all the populist shit you like, but at the end of the day, there's no way to vote against AIPAC or Saudi Arabia in the American political system.
Right.
Okay, so that's where we are now, but I guess I'd like to go back through some of the book. And like I said, reading this book is like a... It's like a horror novel. It's all the more frightening because you know the ending, right?
Yeah,
like,
and exactly.
It's just building this like steady sense of dread, or like it's like that horror movie, The Vanishing, where it's like there's no like jumping out, but you know you're gonna get buried alive at the end of it. And it's like, you know, what it describes is like in this question of like how did this happen, and what the book really describes is that this dark constellation of people and events aligned perfectly to allow this guy to like exploit all of the fissures in American society and just like the monumental arrogance and ignorance of both the media and Democratic Party establishment in particular, but really the arrogance and ignorance of like everyone.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Yeah, everybody. Anybody who had power in this country and had a role in how we choose presidents. You know, I mean, I think all these weaknesses had been there, and if anybody had been paying attention, they would have noticed it. But
well, early on you talk about sort of like the lens or heuristic through which you sort of approached this campaign season was something that you developed covering a previous election in the Great Derangement. Was that the 2004 or election?
Well, that was a little later. It was actually, by then it was the 2008 was the next one I was covering.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you write here, like the sort of formula that you came up with in that book is that the country's leaders are corrupt and have become unresponsive to the needs of the population. People all over are beginning to notice. And this being America, as ordinary people tune out their corrupt leaders, they will replace official propaganda with conspiratorial explanations even more ridiculous than the original lies.
Right.
Could you talk a little bit more about like how this book grew out of the Great Derangement and how it sort of like helped you see what was going on?
Yeah, I mean, I had all these experiences as a reporter like a decade ago that kind of led me to thinking that something like this could happen. One of them was I was going undercover. I lived among a bunch of people who were in this apocalyptic church in Texas for a while. And then I was hanging around the 9/11 truth movement. And then I was also covering, you know, presidential elections at the same time. And the idea that people were beginning to feel like the government didn't work. They were beginning to say that, you know, the people they were voting for, they weren't satisfied with the results that they were getting from that. And they also were starting to tune us in the media out and beginning to feel more emboldened to seek out alternative explanations, you know, the internet, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I think that left the door wide open for Trump. Trump's basic argument was all this shit is corrupt. They're all liars. I have the solution for you. And, you know, people had been primed for a decade to to be ready for this kind of argument. And it was just amazing to me that people in Washington didn't see this coming, because they just... they believed that they could keep rolling out the same stuff over and over again and it would keep working.
Right. I mean, as somebody who, like, one of my things that I had to do this year was make a final map of predictions for the Electoral College was, like, you know, I'll never forget, you know, three things. It was the episode you were on, it was the episode Dan O'Sullivan was on, and it was when we were all in Philadelphia watching the convention. Ugh. When Hillary sent up fucking Michael Bloomberg and Leon Panetta. Ugh. And people were like, this is great. And we were like, who's voting for this? Like, who? Like, somebody who's like, has extremely high deductible and can't afford the care that they're mandated to pay for sees, like, oh, what, is that the guy who ran the CIA under Clinton?
Right.
Hell yeah, dude. Love Trump's hate. Hell yeah. And
the guy who came up with the legal construct for drone assassination.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, exactly.
And we would look at the map. Although, like, on November 7th, we were looking over this big map, like we were in fucking Strangelove, and we were like, we don't actually see why any of these people would go out and vote for her. Like, they have no reason to. But then we're like, yeah, ground game.
Right.
Because that makes sense. Like, if you don't want to do something, like a fucking 23-year-old Oberlin graduate going, like, fucking just wagging their finger at you is going to make you do it.
Yeah, but right. And then what we found out afterwards, though, is that they didn't even fucking have a ground game.
Yeah, that was
the other thing.
They were operating off of the Obama playbook, but they had replaced it with some shitty algorithm.
Oh, yeah, what was it called again?
Because they watched Moneyball too many times.
Was it called Athena or something like that? Or
Yeah.
Let's just say it was
Athena. It was Athena because it turned out never to be there all along.
No, they were literally. It was literally like Team America, where they were like, computer, you know, and intelligence. What state should we concentrate our resources in? It was ridiculous.
It was like Metal Gear Solid 2. When you meet the president. Everything's like Metal Gear Solid 2. This is the most prophetic game of all time, and I'm sick of answering questions about why I haven't read fucking books when only one thing predicted the future. In Metal Gear Solid 2, you meet the president, and he actually grabs the main character by his genitalia, also predictive. But he goes, you don't understand, the computer runs everything. He's talking about the AI that you have to fight in the game.
Yeah.
But really, it turns out the computer that ran everything was just telling Robbie Mook to run ads in Hawaii.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, but I remember being, I was at the Republican convention, and I remember running into a Democratic operative and like at a coffee shop. And he sat me down, and he basically went through all the math, and he said, these 19 things have to happen for Donald Trump to win the presidency, and it's impossible. Like, you know, he has to get 79% of, you know, people who didn't go to high school and have one leg, and you know, and it was so convincing. Like, I came out of that like, wow, like, this is all pointless. They're going to lose, but they were talking to each other, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I mean, like, one of the things I like about the book is that, sort of like us, you admit, like, you got, like, a lot of the questions right, and you got a lot of the details exactly right, and you totally saw how Donald Trump just, like, was able to wash the entire field of Republicans and kind of enjoy it, quite frankly, as we all did. But, you know, me too, like, I couldn't see him winning in the general election.
Right, yeah. And some of that was because there was also this pressure, I think, around that time. There were, like, people on the progressive side who, if you said anything like, well, this campaign's kind of not
sort
going
of like,
well.
Like Candyman, like, if you say it, it'll happen.
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, immediately on Twitter, I noticed this, that if you said anything like, well, I'm not sure about that strategy, like, there would be all these people who would pop out of nowhere. And I think a lot of reporters, I don't know, do you agree? A lot of reporters just sort of didn't say stuff.
I totally agree. Yeah. I totally agree. Like, Steve Kornacki in MSNBC, he was one of the few people that sort of predicted voting patterns accurately, and he would do it very hypothetically and go, well, you know, if, like, these counties switch over from Obama to Trump, like, it would be very good for him in the Rust Belt, and, like, they show a high sign of doing that. And he could probably break the blue wall if he did that. And of course, like the Unite Blue crowd, Sarah Kendzior especially, who's marketing herself as like the person who saw it all coming, is like, you're trying to will a Trump victory into happening. Right, right. It's like, are you a fucking sports radio caller?
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy.
And you look at Trump, like, it's not like Trump rode in on a groundswell of unusual GOP support. He rode in on an unusual number compared to the last 8 years of people just sitting this one out.
Right.
Like, a guy like that wins. A guy like that is able to meet, like, oh, here's the 17 things that have to happen. Here's all the people that don't have to vote. Here's all the people that have to fucking stay home. A guy like that gets in on that. He gets in on people who rightfully feel unrepresented and go, well, you know, there's no reason for me to vote.
Right.
That's why he won, though, that supposed blue wall in the Great Lakes.
Right.
Because all those fucking people stayed home.
Yeah.
Also, it's one detail that actually Adam Curtis brought up when we interviewed him that I think was a surprise to me at the time, talking about laying the groundwork, is when Trump went out there and in the debates just said the Iraq War was a big lie.
Right.
Just said, like, which was orthodoxy to be a conservative and a Republican. Right. Pretty much up until that moment, you'd be like, no, Iraq was good. Even maybe, like, those weapons are still out there and stuff. But he just said, nah, that was bullshit. And everyone was like, yeah, actually it was. Like, those orthodoxies were just sort of pasted on to people's brains without any real belief behind them or any kind of – and then they started to think, yeah, the Bush administration, the Republican establishment, they lied to us about that too. The distrust ran deeper than just libs and big government. It was like even WMD, I think that lurking in their minds was like, maybe that was fucking bullshit too. And Trump said that.
Yeah.
And they embraced it.
And then the economic explanations too, because you have all these like sort of National Review types who said, oh, well, the reason why your life sucks and you don't have a job is because corporate taxes aren't low enough. and they legitimately really believed that people would keep buying that over and over and over again. Whereas Trump comes in and he says the Republican Party is wholly owned by people who want to ship your job overseas, which is true.
Yep.
Right. And they're not going to bring the jobs back. I'm going to bring jobs. And so. Of course that's going to be.
Yeah, I have a quote here from the book. You're right. What these Tweety Buckleyites at places like The Review don't get is that most people don't give a damn about conservative principles. Yes, millions of people responded to the rhetoric for years, but that wasn't because of the principle itself, but because it was always coupled with a more effective politics of resentment. The fact that lots of voters hated the Clintons, Sean Penn, and the Dixie Chicks, and whomever else, it did not ever mean that they believed in the principle that each of Detroit car makers being able to cautiously move American jobs overseas by the thousands.
Yeah, no, exactly, right? And you saw that when the National Review does that 20-person, you know, line in the sand.
Against
right?
Trump.
Exactly. And the, like the crickets, you could hear it like all the way across the country.
Next week, they're going to have four Trump, a symposium. Yeah. I swear to God.
Well, only a couple months later, Conrad Black, of all people, had contributing, and he was like the guy they pushed out to be like, okay, we have to start reversing this against Trump thing now. Can you do that? And he was like, he said the article was called Trump's Gonna Fix It. National Review, no more than 4 months later, was like, Trump's gonna fix it.
God,
and here's Conrad
pathetic.
Black to tell you why.
Can you imagine being in the editorial meeting and just saying, okay, I guess it's time to suck it up and do this, right? That's pathetic.
Another major thread of the book is how Trump defeated the press over and over again, and probably deservedly so. Could you talk a little bit about what the media seal of death is, how it works, like what purpose it serves, and how Trump beat it over and over again on the campaign trail?
So this is really embarrassing because we're not supposed to admit this stuff in public. But, you know, obviously we've seen this script before. A candidate does something stupid, like Howard Dean with the scream or Gary Hart with the monkey business thing. And the reporters, we all know what the script is, right? Like there's 5,000 negative reports. The candidate goes into hiding briefly before he decides whether or not he's going to apologize. Then there's the apology. Then they try to kind of stick it out for a while, and then they exit. And we know that script, right? And I have a friend on the trail who was we joked about it. We call it the seal of death. This idea, and they tried it with Trump a bunch of times, like over and over and over again, like with the, and I think it started with the McCain, I like people who aren't captured thing, and it didn't work. And I think reporters were shocked that they didn't have the power to just wipe out candidates anymore. And
but also, it's like it's a power to enforce a certain kind of orthodoxy mm-hmm. of thought and like what is acceptable. And you use the Howard Dean example, and even before the yarg moment, he was you write about how he was subjected to, you know, like a certain tone of questioning, like, you know, aren't you too strident
right.
about Iraq and things like that, which was, you know, at the time still like within well within the mainstream of what is acceptable political thought. And then Trump does these things where, like, sometimes, for instance, like what he said about WMDs, sometimes he does say something that's truthful, and it's like the press reaction to that is even weirder. They don't know what to make of that either.
Oh, or they wouldn't admit it, which is even worse because it's not like people don't pay attention, you know? Like the thing with Trump made Woody Johnson and Jeb Bush, that was a big part of his stump speech for a while, this idea that Jeb Bush isn't going to lower your drug prices because Woody Johnson's his campaign chairman. Totally true, right? And yeah. it's a perfect example of why politics doesn't work in this country. And, you know, but they didn't give him credit. I mean,
by the way, isn't Woody Johnson going to be our ambassador to England now?
It's, I mean, like, he hasn't fucked up the Jets enough. Like, he's got to go.
I think we should make Rex Ryan our ambassador. It'd be like a King Ralph.
I mean, I think that Rex Ryan would be a perfect ambassador to Saudi Arabia. Shared interest in feet.
Oh, that's terrible.
There was a similarity in between what media people thought would be effective and what, like, Aikido practitioners think. They get so used to being in this closed environment where these norms, whether they're, like, you can't insult John McCain because all you fucking corn-eating hamheads love him, and, you know, if you touch a guy's wrist in a certain way, he'll fly across the room.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
They're enforced in such a way, and you have such a closed-off world there. You go out in the world, and it just doesn't work when someone just runs up on you and hits you or throws you to the ground, as Trump did.
Ironically, Hunter Thompson wrote about this once. He talked about people who, I think it's in Hell's Angels, he talked about how a lot of people take karate classes and they think that if they do this move and that move, it's kind of working. In reality, in a bar fight, whoever throws the first punch the hardest wins.
Like, yes.
Yes. You know what I mean? And you have to have that experience. And a lot of, again, the campaign trail has traditionally been this province of, like, myopic eggheads who think that they can run the process, and Trump just completely rocked their world. They just didn't know how to deal with it, right? Yeah. And that's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, they still don't know how to deal with it. Like, I remember reading, I think it was from Dylan Byers last week, in response to a lot of people just saying now, like, after the just fucking absurd press conferences, Sean Spicer are just saying, like, why even have White House press briefings? Like, why are these people even sending journalists to talk about this? And Dylan Byers is like, well, I gotta say, I'm just shocked by all this. Isn't it better to just have his lies documented and on the record? And it's like, dude, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. And people keep asking this week, like, what's going to happen when he expels the press corps from the White House? Well, they'll fucking just do their jobs from somewhere else. Like, who cares? You know what I mean? Like,
first question, Breitbart. second question, Stormfront in the back.
It basically boils down to the fact that there's a symbiotic relationship between traditional politicians and the media,
mm-hmm.
right? Because most people, especially when they're running for president on a national scale, has never heard of these assholes. And so it's basically the media's job to, in collaboration with the candidate, basically shape a version of them for people to be introduced to and to give them an idea of who they are.
Right.
Trump, because he was a celebrity, had a prefabricated brand then he didn't need the media to help him create. And so that relationship just broke down
right.
because he wasn't a politician.
That's 100% correct. Because what people need to remember, who are politicians? Most of them, before they enter Congress, they're like fourth-rate lawyers, right, who get elected from these like little podunk towns. And then they get gradually built up. They have profile. And then in order to be turned into these mythic godlike characters, they need the overwhelming attention of lots and lots of media people, but you don't need that if you're Donald Trump. He just bypassed that entire exercise, and, you know, he's a celebrity by himself without the help of all these sycophants.
And talking about TV and celebrity, I think another thing I want to talk about here is you talk about the contrast between the way the press covered Trump and the way they covered Bernie, both as the kind of the outsiders, the kind of dark horse candidates who nonetheless had this huge momentum behind them. And the fact that they would just put all of Trump's speeches on TV completely unedited because, hey, everyone just assumed it's business. He gets ratings.
Right.
Whereas if you were to put like an entire Bernie speech on the air unedited, it would be assumed that the producer or whatever is trying to make some kind of statement because of the content of those speeches. And I just want to read here real quick. It says, Trump sold hate, violence, xenophobia, racism, and ignorance, which oddly enough had long been permissible zones of exploration for American television entertainment. And the news media was becoming more and more indistinguishable from entertainment. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders talked about poverty and inequality, which are now and have always been taboo. And I read that and it just made me think of the way like shows like sitcoms like The King of Queens, where he's a UPS driver but like lives in this big ass house. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, exactly. like the way poverty and stuff is just completely absolutely like blanked out on television entertainment.
What's the only show about the Good Times was what they called the show about black poverty. Remember that? I mean
it's like Frank Grimes in The Simpsons when he goes over to you live in this huge house. Aren't you just a low level technician? He's like, and Homer's like, I don't know what you mean. This is how I live.
But like Trump is a TV, he's already a TV character, playing a TV character on television. And like another point you make out is like, that is what people relate to. He gets all of his news from TV. He thinks TV is real. He responds to it like it's real, which is how most voters do as well.
Exactly, exactly. And that was another thing the media got wrong, is because they were all like, oh, how could Donald Trump have any link to the common man? He's a billionaire. He doesn't share their experience. Of course he shares their experience. He's doing exactly the same shit that they are all day long. He's on the internet.
He's eating McDonald's.
He's eating McDonald's. He's probably watching the same porn. You know what I mean? and he does. You know, he has that in common with them. And you know, the tweeting is intimate. It's, you know, right? I mean, I don't know. I thought that was interesting. Whereas Hillary Clinton, you know, she talks in those letters in the Podesta letters, you know, or some of those transcripts that they're released, you know, like I'm out of touch, you know, I haven't been around ordinary people for a long time, and it's because they have a different lifestyle, you know, and whereas his lifestyle, Trump's lifestyle,
like Trump is not around ordinary people either, but he has a comparable lifestyle and mentality.
Right. Exactly.
And like, Matt, I mean, you like, or Felix too, we had the exact same feeling walking around the National Mall, looking at the MAGA chuds, as we're now calling them, seeing the chuds up close, you really realize like they respond to Trump because he is them.
That's what they would do if they had a billion or pretended to have $1 billion.
Yeah.
They would live in a hideous, gilded, shitty penthouse. Yeah. They would like make other rich people eat their shit like out of just resentment. They would absolutely do that.
Yeah. And I mean, like these aren't like poor people. Like they're just, you know,
no, yeah, they're like fat, suburban they're versions fat, of middle Trump with their hideous McMansions and three Ski-Doos in the fucking driveway. The only difference is that the one thing that Trump doesn't do that they would do if they had billions of dollars is get an entire warehouse full of Dale Earnhardt Jr. memorabilia.
Yeah. Folks, I like people who don't crash into the walls. Okay?
Folks, when we play Mario Kart, Baron is always Luigi. I'm always Wario. Oh,
I am, and believe me, this is true. The Japanese said, I have won the most matches playing as Peach.
But like, in terms of, again, like the ordinary person, like you also, like, you're going out on these campaign events, you're talking to Trump voters. Another thing you talked about is how his message resonated among not unions, but individual union members who you talked to, who came out to his events and were responding to what Trump was saying.
Yeah, and I actually had competing members of the same union, like, talking to me. Like, there was one guy who was a Bernie supporter who was, like, sort of trolling a Trump event, and he was saying, see, those three guys are there in my local. And I tried to talk to them about Bernie. They'd never heard of Bernie. They've heard of Trump. That's why they're here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was a phenomenon that, you know, you would try to talk to these people and say, did you hear that thing you said about how people in Detroit auto workers should make less? And they're like, yeah, well, whatever. You know, it was much more about cultural resentment, you know. And again, it was just hating the kind of people who are on the other side much more than it was about
I talked to union guys or ex-union guys too last year when I was doing some pieces on this, and you know, completely agree that what they would talk about is not Trump's specific, you know, of which there were none, specific plans or policies to return these jobs or anything like that. But they talked about NAFTA, mm-hmm. how the Clintons and also Republicans sold them down the river, which they're right about.
Exactly.
And they spoke very, you know, knowledgeably about that kind of stuff. And then I'd be like, did you, what about, there was another candidate running. Did you hear about Bernie Sanders? What did you think about Bernie? And I remember this one guy was talking to me. He's like, ah, oh, he was a little bit wacky for me. This guy's Trump. He's going for Trump. And he's like, Bernie Sanders, he's a wacky. And I was like,
I didn't like his misogynoir.
And he was, and I was like, what made you feel he was wacky? He's like, well, you know, I just, I think of Venezuela. You know, I hear Bernie Sanders talk, I think of Venezuela. And later on in the conversation, so he's, you know, spooked by socialism. And later
he's
on
in
the conversation.
Union.
Yeah, I know. Later on, he was just like, he was talking about Brexit. He's like, you know, they got a, you know, Brexit over there, you know, it's the same kind of thing. And they've got a pretty good thing going over in Britain. And now that they, immigrants are showing up, you know, maybe that's going to get taken away from them. And I was like, so you're for Brexit. You know, in Britain, they have they've socialized medicine. That's actually like to the left of what Bernie Sanders wants. Mm-hmm. And you're saying, sounds like you're saying that that's pretty good. That's a good deal for them. They like it. That connection never even occurred before.
Yeah.
It was either Trump, who just bashed NAFTA and all this stuff, and then no other option.
Right.
Because the main Democrat in the race just was a complete out of touch relic of this political class that they hated.
I mean, like by the end of the campaign, Hillary had to come out and sort of half-heartedly be against the TPP.
Yeah.
Right.
While Obama was pushing it on late night shows, and Tim Kaine was like, she doesn't actually mean it.
Yeah.
That was so classically Clintonian, that entire episode where they're taking like four positions at once and none of the positions are sincere.
Or good.
You know what I mean? Or good. Yeah, exactly.
It was, she scrubbed it from her book. She scrubbed the TPP line from her book when it came out in paperback. It was just deleted.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Non-issue.
Like from what Brendan previously said just now, we're like... And when Matt's sort of written about sort of conspiratorialism in American politics, we're in a similar state to like a lot of Middle Eastern politics where you have such little control over your input in the system and your individual outcome that, conspiracy makes sense. Right. It makes more sense than like looking at everything and seeing the deck stacked against you and realizing that they're like just fucking you right in the open.
Right.
That way you can feel like you've gotten one over on them by figuring it out, whether it's that they, you know, fuck kids in a pizza restaurant or, you know, they did 9/11 to melt gold. And it causes you, like, not to participate. And at the same time, there's, similar to the Middle East, there's been this conscious, systematic destruction of viable leftism.
Right.
So that any anger against the existing system, against the status quo, which is inevitable in either system, gets funneled into, well, in the Middle East, like Salafism. Or here, it gets funneled into like far-right insanity, which they're the same things. Yeah. They're reactionary, irredentist viewpoints that you will immediately slot into if socialism has been destroyed and demonized your entire fucking life and you don't know any better.
Exactly right. The only 9/11 conspiracy theory I ever thought was true was that they were encouraging the 9/11 conspiracy theories.
Just like
the UFO conspiracies of the 80s and 90s, which did turn out to be actively abetted by...
Is that true?
Yeah, that's funny.
That's really funny.
That reminds me. So apparently InfoWars is going to get a credential for the White House.
Why not?
And what I want to know is, are they going to ask Spicer, hey, when are you guys going to arrest George Bush for doing 9/11? Like, it blows my mind that they have like put that as water under the bridge.
Right.
Like, they should have he did 9/11, but Trump's president now, so it's okay.
Well, I mean...
We don't need to... They're like Obama with the tortures. It's like, look, we got to go forward. We got to make America great again. We can't get bogged down with... finger pointing about who blew up what trade center
imagining
demolitions.
I'm just imagining like Spicer's beady little like bloodshot eyes just going, Well, yes, it is an issue. We're concerned about it. We'll look into it. We'll look into it, okay? But ultimately, the president's focused on moving forward. Yeah. And then he just swallows another pack of cinnamon gum. Yeah. That's the only thing he eats.
I mean, InfoWars isn't even that exciting now. Yeah. InfoWars just became like boring mainstream Republican punditry. Like, it used to be Alex Jones just running around screaming at cops and calling them lizards. And now he's like, it's the hardest job that no one appreciates. Blue Lives Matter. InfoWars became boring pundits, and liberal media became InfoWars.
Yeah. That's right. That's true. That's true. Yeah. I think there still has to be a ghoul pool for when Alex Jones's aneurysm happens. Because that is high drama watching him, you know, the veins in his head pop out. It's really funny stuff.
Actually, this is a good one to ask you about. I mean, like, moving from the Republicans and what they're doing, like, but like over to the like the Democrats and like the sort of Main Street Democrats and liberals. You're a guy who's had, you know, not inconsiderable experience covering Russian politics and living there. What do you make of the whole like the whole Russia thing and the reaction to
it? So bizarre, isn't it?
Among liberals and Democrats.
I mean, look, I don't discount the idea that that Putin probably hacked the DNC. I'm fairly convinced by people who tell me that there's good evidence for that. But A, we do that, you know, like, you know, I was there when we openly meddled in the 1996 Russian election. Right. So, you know,
the cover of Time said
Yanks to the rescue.
Yanks to the rescue.
Yanks to the rescue. But this other thing, you know, this idea that they're, you know, the Manchurian candidate and all that stuff, like, okay, if that's true, it's like an unparalleled, you know, conspiracy, and it has to be outed immediately. But we have all these people who are like running wild with that without a whole lot to go on. Yeah. And it's just, I'm just surprised that so many people, I mean, I guess it's because of the depth of their anger towards Trump. But but it feels to me like it's being encouraged both by the Democratic Party and by people in the intelligence community, which is also really weird.
I mean, like, my take on it is, like, I think the liberals and Dems, or a certain kind of them, are really excited by it because it gives them a chance to be nationalistic too.
Yeah
you know, that's true, you're right.
Or they can be like, you know, standing up to Russia, and it's just like, well, you're never,
it's because they think that they can buy your logic, the fucking conservatives, because they think that charging someone with hypocrisy is a meaningful thing that is going to make people change their minds, because they're like, well, you're nationalist, you love America, aren't you concerned the fact that this foreign power intervened in our election? No, because they helped the guy I like.
Right. I mean, in the liberal imagination, like, what is like the biggest liberal jack-off fantasy about the Christian right? It's in the West Wing when the president, like, gets all the religious people in one room. This is, like, seriously a scene in, like, the first episode of the West Wing. And he goes, oh, yeah, so you're against gay people? Well, how about in Leviticus when it says that you can't, you know, eat shrimp? Should I put you to death for that? And that just shuts them down. Like, that homophobia comes from just, like, a literalist reading of the Bible and not just innate hatred or fucking resentment of a shitty person.
They're like, I was okay with gay people until I finally read every verse of Leviticus.
Which, like, no one has done. It's not why people hate gay people, you fucking morons. Yeah.
It just came out that that some members of the top Trump inner circle, including Bannon, still have private emails servers, and they asked Republicans, what do you think about that? And the majority were like, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, exactly. And you're exactly right that there's this whole collection of people who think that's going to be a game changer, right? Like but it doesn't work like that. Like, it, you know, it's not a Princeton debating society, this stuff. It's just people are who they are. They believe what they believe. They have the passions that they have. And it's a much deeper thing than pointing them out. You know, that's why I was so frustrated by all this. Oh, the media isn't calling Trump out enough. Like they would care if we, you know what I mean?
They wouldn't give a shit. And, like, also, I think, like, just circling back, like, it's in the vested interest of a lot of people to think of politics as a game of debate and finding people's double standards and hypocrisies. Because if it's not that, and it is what it actually is, which is a contest of resources, a contest of the division of power, and a contest of who gets what. I mean, you already, like, you poll people very directly. What do they want? They want universal health care. Right. They want higher taxes for the rich. They want all these things that we're told are fringe. But there's a vested interest in representing politics. It's like, ooh, well, you know, you win an election when you fucking catch your opponent in a no true Scotsman. Right. It's of the vested interest to totally obscure what this whole thing is about.
Sure.
Right. Sure. Right. Exactly.
The big part of the book is about how Trump played everybody, but like the media especially, because they had no idea what to do with him because of the fact that he is a show business guy. And as you write, he understands that the presidential election is a billion-dollar TV show. And he's a TV host. Like, that's what he does. And and he played that beautifully. But also, like, how the press dealt with, or rather didn't deal with, Bernie Sanders comes up in this. And you have a chapter called, like, how the Democrats are going to learn exactly the wrong lesson from their brush with Bernie. That, again, was hugely prophetic given how it turned out in the general election, where Hillary Clinton ended up losing all of the states where the dark horse outside her upset her.
Right.
The first time in the primary.
I mean, I think this is, we talked about this the first time I was on the show, right? I mean, this was right around that time, right around the convention. Everybody was like, oh, well, we're past that whole thing. You know, we don't have to worry about that anymore.
Well, you write that, like, again, like, a big thing is, like, everybody thought, myself included, that Trump getting the nomination would shatter the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
And the exact opposite happened.
Right.
Yeah. Right? Like, the Democratic Party is the one that's broken right now. And they're broken because they had this huge upswell, particularly among young people, their next generation of voters, that absolutely did not want Hillary Clinton as the nominee and probably voted for her begrudgingly, if at all. You talk about there are two examples from the Washington Post from James Homan, who we talked about before, does the Daily 202, and Jonathan Capehart, both of them saying, look, Hillary Clinton had her big Super Tuesday win. I think we can put this to bed forever. Yeah. She doesn't need the left.
Right.
She doesn't need the left. She's so much bigger than that.
Right.
And this is back to the Democratic Party business as usual, which is just, you know, throw a few scraps to the liberal base and then just go full steam ahead with the kind of neoliberal corporate agenda.
Right. But you know why that is, though? It's because people like that in Washington, everybody they know has the same opinion, right?
And so
the idea that there's millions of people out there who want something else or who have a different point of view on things is totally alien to them because they don't have any experience with, you know, I mean, I talk to people who work in Congress and their idea of like what a, they used to hate answering constituent phone calls because the idea of talking to actual people was so annoying. You know what I mean? Like, we don't need to do this. We don't need you to do this job.
To be honest, and having worked customer service, it is really fucking annoying.
Of course.
It sucks.
Of course, but at least be cognizant.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's why that happens. So, yeah.
Hello, Senator Schumer. Senator Schumer, I ordered the Christmas ornaments from you. They arrived broken. My grandchildren are crying, sir. But yeah, what did the press and then like the Democrat? I mean, it should be obvious, but like how do you rate, like, how did they consciously try to dismiss Bernie Sanders because they don't believe in what he does, or like he seems so crazy like to them because they don't really believe in
the press hated Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
They hated him, and you know, I'm a little older, you know, and I remember going back, there's been a little bit of an analog to Bernie in each election. You know, you go back to Dennis Kucinich, right? They hated Dennis Kucinich because I vividly remember Candy Crowley like scoffing audibly while she was watching Dennis Kucinich on a monitor during the debate, because they were just disgusted that a person like this would even be running for president, like wasting their time. Like the people who are used to this, they have this image of what a presidential candidate is supposed to be like, and Bernie's not that. He looks funny.
Yep.
He doesn't have a sense of humor about the process. He's not into the West Wing. You know what I mean? Just like what you're saying. And they didn't want him to run. And the fact that he got so many votes, just they wanted it to be a sideshow that they could forget forever. And it's not, right? I mean, it was a movement, so I don't know.
Yeah, normally the campaign journalism is about, as you've said, for journalists, is the horse race and it's the clown show and all this other stuff. It was foreign to be covering a movement, like a socially conscious thing happening among a broad base of people. That was like this annoying,
yeah,
to them probably boring and hard thing to shoehorn in to the normal agenda and the normal scheduling for a campaign season. So you could tell that they were just like, well, we're not going to play his speeches, you know, we're going to get into all these little debates, and that's that. Let's just stick to what we
know. We're looking for that thing.
Yeah,
and this it'll run.
But you also you also have some great great examples of how they tried to put their finger on the scale for the Republican candidates as well, and God, it just made me remember after Iowa when they were like, the real winner is Marco.
Yeah,
oh, look for the Marco momentum coming Marco out of Iowa.
I remember like seeing Marco's shit in New Hampshire, and it was just like, first of all, his staffers were the biggest pieces of shit that I met. They were the worst. They all,
you've described them repeatedly as all his illegitimate kids.
They were all his kids. Like white, Hispanic, Indian, they all had Marco's fucking stupid face and haircut.
That's so true. I never thought of that. Yeah. That's hilarious.
And they were just all like, you would go up to them and they would just sneer at you if you weren't from like CNN. And there was this feeling of both sexually frustrated ice chewing and impatience. Like, why do we have to keep doing this when we know Marco's going to be the fucking nominee?
Right.
Why am I here?
Right.
Just petulance.
Yeah.
And they too did not understand what type of year this was. They rented this huge room in like one of the only like nice hotels in New Hampshire. It had this big TV on it to watch like Marco come in fucking third.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. His people were definitely, you wanted to throw them in an acid bath.
They were like, Kasich is like, as far as policy, like as bad as Marco and even worse in some areas. But like all his people are just like telegenic Mormon looking people who are like, how are you doing? It's great that you're at a Kasich thing. If you want coffee. But all Marco's people were just like, I just have to fucking get through this so I can be the undersecretary of fingernail pulling. This is the biggest pieces of shit. I was so happy when he cried.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was, the Marco thing was funny because even when he like, not just lost, but cried because things didn't go his way.
Yeah.
And then was like, he basically said, like, I have to think about it one or two days before I completely kiss Trump's ass. So they were like, that shows what a good man he is. It's like, that actually shows the opposite of what you think it does.
Thinking back over the GOP clown car, it was just so obvious. Like, Trump just out-alphaed all of them, and that's not even a big achievement. Like, that's a low bar to clear. And Matt and I were talking about this in D.C. If it wasn't for our stupid Constitution, Schwarzenegger could have gotten there and alphaed all of them.
Oh, my God.
Including Trump. Including Trump.
Yeah, probably.
Trump, yeah, Schwarzenegger would be president right now if it wasn't for the stupid Constitution.
That would be so fucking cool.
Like, he would have done to Trump what he did to Lou Ferrigno in Pumping Iron. Humiliated him.
Can you imagine, like, because they, like, obviously they would both be the guy, if they'd grind against each other, who's got a better brand, you know?
Arnold.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there's no contest. There's going to be trial by combat for the presidency, and then
like Schwarzenegger would appear like on stage with Trump, and he'd be like, "Hello, Donald. I called my wife today. I already won. It's okay."
Do you guys remember
this
when
this man wears a diaper?
Do you guys remember when Marco, like, when he lost it, and he was like, "Trump is a small dick." His like hedge fund, his like a hardcore Christian hedge fund donors were like, Marco, no, rethink this. You are better than this. And he had to apologize to Trump while Trump talked about what a big dick he has. That was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, God.
That was the total Idiocracy moment from the campaign, though. That was the, you know, Welcome to America brought to you by Carl's Jr. Fuck you moment. that was crazy.
So You go back, like, you know, through this whole, like, you know, nightmarish and sort of the dark comedy of this campaign season, and you talk about how, like, the press didn't really know what to make of a kind of a populist movement either on the right and the left. And in the epilogue of your book, you talk about that what that sort of populist movement on the right looks like, and you talk about kind of the epilogue of this book is sort of the end of the kind of liberal era that you clock as beginning with the March on Washington in 1963 and the rise of a kind of right-wing populism or like the alt-right. And I was wondering if you could just like the whole end of the book is basically about the rise of this kind of white identity politics and tribalism that has kind of filled that void from the collapse of like the kind of liberal order that we've seen. And I was wondering if you just like, could you talk a little bit more about
that? Sure, yeah. And one of the things that that I got wrong during the campaign. You know, if you went to Trump's rallies, these alt-right types weren't really there. Like,
no, they're too weak. Yeah.
So this,
they've got gaming to do.
Yeah, exactly. They're campus conservatives, and they think of themselves as, like, you know, the same way that the Bolsheviks thought of themselves in relation to the peasantry. They're the vanguard of right. this other movement. So I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to them until Steve Bannon, you know, suddenly enters the picture as, like, the second most powerful person in the country. And, you know, their belief system coincides with a lot of the things that Trump talked about. And it was all culture first. And, you know, we don't really believe that people are going to eventually get along, and there's right. the racial holy war, all that stuff. It was a subtext of the campaign all along, and you know, I just think it's we had this sort of unspoken idea that the I Have a Dream speech was how it was the model for what we're supposed to think about in terms of race relations, and that's over now. Right?
But like, even conservatives, right?
Even
like,
conservatives, they would pay lip service to
saying, like, you know, the content of your character line, and they
MLK was a conservative.
Yeah, yeah, like, right, or yeah, claim them for himself, or at least like not openly despise everything right. he stood for.
Right. Right. And now that's all bets are off. They have permission to dismiss that, and yep. we have a new. We're considering other models for how we're going to get along.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was interesting. Like, for the past, like, 25, 30 years, the concessions that Republicans and Democrats in Washington, at the federal government, at the legislative level, got out of each other just by coexisting socially was, like, on the, you know, Republican side, they got Democrats to, you know, go, well, yeah, no, we have to believe in a strong defense. We have to fight all enemies. We have to fight all foreign enemies. You have to stand behind the president in a time of war. Just all this bullshit that would give a blank check to the deep state and totally pin them to vote in a certain way. Whereas the only thing this is Democrats kind of got out of Republicans was for them to vaguely speak to this I Have a Dream idea. That what, like, the I Have a Dream speech isn't even, it obviously isn't even what we culturally understand it as. Like, Letter from Birmingham Jail is a more comprehensive representation of what King believed, of
right.
course.
Sure. Right.
But it's...
Well, but there was a reason for that, though, because that was the big moment, and he didn't want to oversell. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But, I mean, even if you read that speech, it's not like... You know, it's not even like... The message of that speech is like, I don't see race. Like, it's not right. like... But that was the concession that Democrats sort of yanked out of Republicans by coexisting socially with them in this weird bubble, for them to speak to this very surface level refutation of racism while still, you know,
that eventually will turn into something positive.
While still, you know, enacting voter suppression and fucking everything else. Yeah. But yeah.
Right. Right. And now we don't even have that.
Right.
So the alt-right, like, as a political movement, do you think the media or politics in general, do you think people are giving them too much lip service or not enough?
So I never thought that they were the driving force of all this hatred and anger. Like, it's just kind of the same way that it's, like, Leviticus isn't the reason people hate homosexuals.
Yeah,
right, yeah. I just think that they're appropriating, you know, things that are already out there, and they, because they're a bunch of college educated people, you know, self-described smart guys, they're going to weasel their way into government. They're going to be the people who end up in positions of power, and they're going to have an ability to impact things much more than everybody
else.
They
have a think tank now.
Do they?
National Policy Institute.
Well, that was the Richard Spencer one. Yeah.
The Nationally Punched Institute.
I mean, you bring up, like, the Bolsheviks, and, like, we know about Bannon, that he's obsessed with Lenin. He views Lenin as a political model, and that's what he's going for, basically.
Exactly. Yeah, and it makes, and they have all the elements for the same kind of Leninist, you know, pattern there, right? You have a huge population of people that's pissed off, right? And they're easily manipulated. And then you have a small group of really obnoxious, heartless intellectuals who have no scruples about doing anything. And that's how you get, you know, a disastrous historical movement.
All of our tanky listeners right now are going, "You heard it here. He called Lenin obnoxious."
The idea that, like, they think that everyone is all right, it is kind of funny, because it's like these agoraphobic people with clinic, like, just who never leave the house. They're like, "See, Everyone agrees with us. America was not racist before we started posting.
Yeah, people are just white folks voting Republican.
Yeah,
yeah.
Are now more self-consciously voting for whiteness.
Yes.
Right. Right. Exactly.
But still voting at the exact same numbers they did before.
Yeah.
Right. But they're but the code, there's no code words anymore. Right. You don't have to dog whistle. You can sit like their culture first is now.
Yeah.
That's not that far from some of the things. I mean, I hate to do the whole Nazi thing, but they are using a lot of language that's pretty similar.
Well, Trump did say America first twice in his inaugural speech, and you close out the book with this paragraph that I thought was very poignant. You say, meanwhile, the pessimism of Trump's revolution is intentional, impassioned, and ascendant. They placed a huge bet on America's worst instincts and won. And the first order of business will be to wipe out a national idea in which they never believed. Welcome to the end of the dream. That's I mean, it's tough stuff, but I mean, it's like it's all right there.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah,
like,
yeah.
And that dream, like that liberal dream that I've lived in my entire life, that era is over now.
Right. We never knew anything else.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. And if the dream is over, then that means we were asleep to begin with.
Yeah.
So like now we're awake, so like now what we do counts, basically. Or
right.
Or it should, or we should try to make it count.
Yeah. No, I mean it was incomplete before, and the vagueness of that allowed us to kind of this sort of weird nervous detente to mm-hmm. exist for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and now it's like the final showdown, right? Like, or we have something is going to have to give during this era, but the problem is I'm not hugely confident in the ability of the sort of except for the fact that Trump is so totally unpopular.
banking on that in a big way.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't underestimate like the ability of these people to just trip over their own dicks over and over again. Like,
yeah. And I think there are some, like, you know, there are some encouraging signs. Like, it's encouraging that millions of normies went out and hit the streets, and if they do it again, fucking great. And it's also encouraging that there has been a huge uptick in sort of genuine left politics and organizing. It's still like, it's still smaller than it is in other countries, but it's, the rise is undeniable mm-hmm. of places like DSA or even PSL.
Yeah.
And there's a shitload of work to be done, but the future does belong to people who have totally seen through the norms that never really existed in the first place.
Right.
I don't know what's going to happen. It is sort of anyone's game right now, but I see a lot of encouraging signs.
Well, yeah. my thought is like when we were out at the march on Saturday, and like I said, there was like, I would say the majority of people there were still with her, you know?
Right.
And if she had shown up in D.C. and spoken at that or marched in the crowd or done anything really, like it would have been electric. Like those people would have gone insane. They would have been just overjoyed in this moment of solidarity. Of course she didn't. So I'm wondering, like, what's it going to take to make those people realize that Hillary Clinton doesn't really give a shit about you?
And not only that, but also I was talking with a friend last night who was she's a labor organizer who was really kind of despairing about not only the things we've been talking about in Trump and stuff like that, but also the state of the left. And I think there are some encouraging signs, but you know, what I thought of is that Obama was a dangerous thing for the left and for progressives in many ways. He made the old guard kind of complacent, mm-hmm. and he made the younger, you know, a whole 8 years worth of people who might have entered into a more antagonistic relationship with politics and power, they just sort of felt, not crazily, they felt, he's kind of got this.
He's
a good guy. He's not doing everything perfect, but
he seems like me.
And of course, you know, we all know about the amazing, you know, charisma, and then of course disappointments of Obama. But that left everybody wide open
mm-hmm.
to suddenly confront what it's like to feel like I need to get fucking involved immediately. There was not that urgency under Obama.
Right.
And now there's no greater emergency for those same types of people with Trump in power.
It was there for Obama's campaign. Like there's this huge swell of energy
coming out of Bush.
Yeah, exactly. And now that has to reappear again, but it has to find a better vessel. this time
well,
around.
Matt, another point you make in the book is that also like this idea of the Obama coalition was something that, you know, you and myself as well like put probably undue faith in the fact that look, America, we've elected now a black president twice. His name is Barack Hussein Obama. Like, isn't that weird? We've done it twice. Like, so like this is just going to keep going. And I feel like there's this sort of pattern in American history. Actually, I believe John Dolan wrote this about the first Reagan administration, is this sense where, like, after like a decade or so, people just sort of think that like all these old, like these Ralph Steadman caricatures, like they're extinct. They've all gone away, but they just keep coming back.
Right.
They're sort of like crew cut, fat necked, like hick fascists. They're still there. And like, they're like, they just keep coming back.
Dude, Ed Meese served on the transition team this year.
My God.
You know?
Did he really?
Yes, he did.
My God, I thought he was dead 50 times between...
No, well, he's pure, never going to die. He's pure evil, so he's probably going to live to be 100.
Yeah.
Like, there we go. Matt Taibbi, the book is Insane Clown President, out published by Spiegel and Gow. It's available in bookstores everywhere.
Gentlemen, thanks. Congratulations on your show, by the way. It's amazing.
It's been amazing
watching you guys in the last year or so. It's been really cool.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, dude.
A lot has changed since like you were last on. We all had sex. Yeah, no more virginity on this show, dude.
You got no cause to hurt me.
No. But I gave my word.
You gave your word?
This is the best I can do. Call it.
I know you was crazy when I saw you sitting there. I know exactly what was in store for me.
Call it.
No. I ain't gonna call it.
Call it.
The coin don't have no say. It's just you.
I got here the same way the coin did.